I said yesterday that the Buddhist teaching is often called the path of purification, and that we are engaged in this purification through meditation, and that we have two things within us which need purification: heart and mind, thinking and emotion. That's what we are constantly concerned with, those two aspects of ourselves. Now, just to give a brief review of yesterday, I talked about the purification of our mental aspects, of our mental formations, of our thinking. And for that we use, in the first instance, the labeling, so that we know what we're thinking in daily life. And in the second instance, the four supreme efforts. They're called supreme because they're quite difficult, but also supremely beneficial. They constitute four of the 37 factors of enlightenment, which depicts their importance. And to repeat, these four supreme efforts: not to let an unwholesome thought arise which has not yet arisen, to make an unwholesome thought cease which has already arisen, to make a wholesome thought arise which has not yet arisen, to make a wholesome thought continue which has already arisen. In other words, to be absolutely sure whether our thinking is wholesome or unwholesome, and substitute with the opposite. It takes practice, but then it becomes habitual. And as it becomes habitual, we have a feeling of security, because we know that whatever the provocation, whatever the circumstance or situation, we're going to be able to substitute the unwholesome with the wholesome until one day the unwholesome no longer arises. That does not mean that we cannot discriminate between good and bad. That would be dreadful. But we don't have to hate or dislike. We can just refrain. Now, the labeling is one part of that, which we learn through the meditation, and the other part is the substitution, which we also learn through the meditation, because we substitute all thoughts, hopefully, with attention on the breath. So we learn both aspects in the meditation. Naturally, we have to practice that in daily life, which will help our meditation. But if we don't practice it in meditation, it won't help our daily life. The two have to go hand in hand. And the meditative process is essential for every person in order to make it possible for the mind to have sharpness and clarity. In Pali, meditation is called bhavana, which means mind training. That's all it is, it's mind training. The Buddha compared an untrained mind to the worst enemy we could have, and a trained mind to the best friend we could ever find. He compared the untrained mind to a blunt axe. If you've ever used an axe, which isn't so likely anymore, which was blunt, you know what a misery that is. And a trained mind, he compared to an axe which has been sharpened. That's exactly what it is. An untrained mind is blunt. It can't stay in one spot, as we all know, and it cannot penetrate because it doesn't have the sharpness to do that. So meditation is essential, but it has to be also supported by what we do in daily living. So the four supreme efforts are for our daily living. Now the first part of that, not to let an unwholesome thought arise, which has not yet arisen, is the most difficult one, and will only come to fruit when we have practiced. Because then we can feel a unpleasant feeling preceding the unwholesome thought. But the second one we can certainly practice, not to let an unwholesome thought continue and substitute it with a wholesome one. And the third one is not so difficult. To make a wholesome thought arise, which has not yet arisen, we can deliberately think something good and continue doing that. Without that, we don't have a spiritual path. Without that, we have nothing but the tedium of everyday living, which has its good sides, naturally, but it doesn't go anywhere. A spiritual growth is something which is uplifting, inspiring, rejuvenating, and brings contentment without outer conditions. That's the path of the mind. Now I also explain something else, and I'll quickly repeat that also, namely the hindrances which are common to everyone and the meditative factors which work against those, which are their antidotes. We have five hindrances. And in the traditional order in which they're usually mentioned, they are our desire for sensual gratification, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. They're sort of like a heading for all the difficulties which beset us. Sometimes one difficulty more than another. Also, we have propensities. Naturally, everybody has a tendency towards one or the other more. But we all have them all. And in the meditation, we have three factors which arise even without being very concentrated so that we can go into a meditative absorption. The first one of those is initial application to the meditation subject, which works as an antidote towards sloth and torpor, laziness and drowsiness of the mind. Automatic antidote. The second one is the one where we can stay on the meditation subject, continued application. Whatever length of time that lasts, it might be not very long, it may be very short-lived, and yet it is an antidote for skeptical doubt, because it gives us the assurance that it's possible, that we can do it, and that when we do it, some peacefulness arises. And that confidence helps us to continue. And one-pointedness, even if it's only very short-lived, one-pointedness has to be part of the meditative process. That's a sharpening of the mind. When you have a pencil, which is blunt, you want to put a point on it so that you can write with it. That's the one-pointedness of any tool. Mind is the most important tool. In fact, it's the only tool there is. Everything else has arisen from mind. So the one-pointedness in the meditation is the antidote for our desire for sensual gratification, because we can't do two things at the same time. When we're one-pointed on the meditation subject, whichever subject it happens to be at the time, we can't desire something else. So these three factors arise in meditation no matter what. And then there are two more which take care of the other hindrances. But take care should not be understood that they eliminate them. They certainly don't. They do not uproot them. They cut them down to manageable proportions. If we don't meditate, some of these hindrances are unmanageable. And they get us into hot water. Desire, sensual desire, gets one into hot water at times. And so does hate. So the next two meditative factors, which are dependent upon concentration, are the delightful sensation, which is going over the threshold from trying to meditate to actually meditating. And when that arises, that's the antidote for ill will, anger. And with it, at the same time, arises joy. But in the first instance, if somebody has got this far, in the first instance of the first absorption, the meditative subject, the meditation subject, is the delightful sensation. The joy is accompanying it. It's impossible not to. When we have delightful sensation, it's absolutely natural to have joy with it. But because the delightful sensation is physical and therefore much stronger, that is our first meditation subject after having let go of the method of the breath. The joy that arises at the same time as the delightful sensation is an antidote against restlessness and worry. Now, if somebody is worrying about the fact that they're worrying a lot, take note of the fact that that is one of the human hindrances. It's a fourth one of five, restlessness and worry. And why do we have restlessness and worry? Because we haven't got what we want. We don't have inner joy. It's quite obvious. So when we do get it in the meditation, obviously it works against that as an antidote. So these are the factors which purify the mind and its mental states. And we should say the purifier mental states. And they are automatic purifications, which of course have to be followed through in day-to-day living. I can't emphasize that enough. I have often noticed that people think that if they sit down once a week for meditation, they're on a spiritual path. Let me assure you, that's not so. And even if one sits down once a day for meditation, one is still not on a spiritual path, unless one practices the four supreme efforts. Purifying one's mind. Anyone can practice that, under any condition. One's workplace is a marvelous place for that, because there are so many things arising in one's workplace which need to be changed in one's mind. One's family is a fantastic place to practice that. Couldn't find a better one. There's always something that makes one negative. And if we are concerned with our environment, and people in the world these days are concerned with their environment, that they don't pollute their rivers too much and cut down all the trees, or all those that are still standing, we should be far more concerned with our environment, which we pollute through our negative thinking. And on the other hand, which we purify through our positive thinking. We purify everything around us through our positive thinking. And that is why also one is very happy to be together with people who have that kind of thinking. It gives a happiness to be concerned with the things which are uplifting. Now, besides our mental states, we have emotional states. And don't we know it? Most people are under the impression that they can think out their lives. But actually, that's a misconception. What we do is we are subject to our emotions and then think the way the emotion has directed us. So it's extremely important to do something about one's emotions. Now again, the Buddha gave four different emotions which we can use. Just like he gave us the four supreme efforts for the mind, he gave us the four emotions for the heart. They're called the four Brahma Viharas, which in English means the divine abodes. I can say God realms, but what it really amounts to is that when we have perfected these four, we have heaven on earth. We have paradise in our own heart. I'm sure nobody thinks that heaven is up there. I think everybody knows that's the sky and not heaven. And if you've ever been in a jet plane, which I think many of you must have been, you know it's not heaven. It's just the sky. That's all. But we have heaven and hell within us, and we can experience it quite easily. So the four divine abidings, or the four supreme emotions, are those that make it possible for us to live in a way which is, even without having complete concentration and meditation, even without having gained enormous insights, they enable us to live on a level of truth and lovingness, security and certainty, which give life a totally different quality. When we're able to arouse love in our hearts without any cause, just because love is the heart's quality, we have security. We can't buy security. People always try. That's why the insurance companies have the largest houses, because people try to buy security. You can't buy it, it's impossible. But you can get it. When we get it in our own heart, through a loving heart, we feel assured. Assured that our own reactions, our own feelings, are not going to be in any manner or form detrimental to our own happiness or other people's happiness. We don't have to have any kind of worry or fear. There's a lot of fear in people. They feel threatened by other people, threatened by what they say and by what they do, threatened by what they might think about me. Although we don't even find out, they don't tell us. They're not that impolite usually. When they do tell us what they think about us, of course it's a bit of a shock. But there's no need to even react. The words in Pali for these four supreme emotions are metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. Metta is the first one, M-E-T-T-A. We usually translate it as loving-kindness. But loving-kindness doesn't have the impact in English that the word love has. Love is loaded with all sorts of ideas, what we think it is. We have a real idea about that. So we're going to call it love. The idea which we have about love, and which is propagated in all our novels, movies, everywhere we look, is the idea that love exists between two people. Two people which are utterly compatible, which are usually young and pretty, which doesn't last either, and which for some odd reason have a chemical attraction which is supposed to last. Most people find out during a course of a lifetime that this is a myth. It doesn't work that way. And most people then think it's either their own fault or the fault of the other person or the fault of both of them, whichever way one looks at it, one tries again. After the third, fourth, fifth or sixth try, one might know better. But a lot of people don't know better, still trying. That's called love in our society. It's a total misconception. It's there's a possibility that people live well together, harmoniously, and love each other. And if they do, it's like a seedbed to have love develop in one's heart. But what love really is, it's a quality of our heart. The heart has nothing else to do. It's not there for anything else. I'm not talking about the pump that pumps our blood. I'm talking about the spiritual heart. That's all it has to do. And if we were to be aware of that, that we all contain love within us, and that we can foster and develop it, we would certainly give it far more attention than we do. In our society, and one can say in practically all developed societies, somewhat developed societies, the mind is the most important factor. We have institutions from 3 years of age until death practically, where we can develop the mind. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. We should develop the mind, particularly if we meditate. But we don't have any institutions where we can develop the heart. So we have to do it ourselves. And most people never even hear about it. They're still waiting for the one person that is going to make it possible for them to finally love somebody. Or they are happy that that one person has come around and so they can love that one person. But what happens with that kind of love, that one-to-one, or one-to-two, one-to-three, however many people happen to be in the family? It's also beset with fear. And fear is part of hate. Now, it doesn't mean one hates a person, but one hates the idea that the person may die, walk away, have other ideas. In other words, that love may end, because we believe that love is situated strictly only in that one person. Since there are 6 billion people on this planet, it's pretty absurd, isn't it? But most people think that way, that our love ability is dependent upon having one person around and having that one person near us, having that one person there. So that creates fear, and with the fear, the love is not pure. And not only that, it creates dependency. It creates a dependency upon not only the person, but also upon the ideas and emotions of the other person. There's no freedom in that. No freedom to love. It's dependent. If we see quite clearly that love is an ability we all have, then we can start developing that ability. Any skill that we have ever developed has come through practice. If we've learned to type, we had to practice. Cook, practice. Whatever it is we've ever learned, we had to practice. Well, we can practice love, and eventually we'll have the skill. Now, love is not owning, having, being together, being near, or being loved back. It's got nothing to do with any of that. Love has nothing to do with finding somebody who's lovable, or checking people out whether they are lovable. If we check ourselves out, honestly enough, we'll find we're not all that lovable either. So why do we expect somebody else to be totally lovable? The only one that's supposed to be totally lovable is an arahant. And there are not that many around for us to practice love on. So it has nothing to do with what the other person is. It has nothing to do with whether the other person wants to be loved, is going to love us back, whether they need love. Everybody needs love. Love is a sort of like a fertilizer. We know that. Small children can't grow without it. TLC, tender loving care. Well, it's the same for grown-ups. There's no difference. But most people want to get it. They'd like to be loved. Well, it's very nice to be loved, but why do we want that? Well, it supports the idea that we are lovable, which we actually know has a sort of not complete truth in it. We do know our own faults. But if somebody loves us, we think, oh, well, that's great, you know. This person doesn't even know that we're like that. They still love us. So we're looking for somebody to love us in order to support our image of ourselves. And then if we can't find somebody, then we feel bereft. People even get depressed about it, or they get into dreadful situations because of it. But it's a totally wrong way of going at it. On the spiritual path, there's nothing to get, not even Nibbana. There's everything to get rid of. The key word on the spiritual path is letting go. If you remember that, you can check it out at home. What can I let go of? So, if that's a key word, if there's nothing to get and everything to let go of, obviously the first thing to let go of is trying to get love. The thing to do is to give it. And that's the whole secret in the spiritual path, also in the meditation. One has to give oneself to the meditation wholeheartedly. If we do it half-heartedly, we certainly get half-hearted results. And they are not usually very satisfying. Wholehearted giving has a chance for wholehearted results. But how do we give ourselves? By not holding ourselves back. By not wanting for ourselves. Now in meditation, this is very easily seen. It's very predominant. Because if we can't stop thinking, it's not because it's impossible to stop thinking, or because we have a mind that can't stop thinking, or any of the other reasons. It's strictly because we haven't given ourselves up for the time of meditation. We need still a support system that we're there. Well, it's the same with love. If we want to be loved, we're looking for a support system. If we want to love, we are looking for spiritual growth. It's quite important. And since you have come here for this weekend, I would assume that you are interested in a spiritual discipline. It's quite important, if one is interested, to write down in a little diary or on a notebook, what do I really want out of life? what's the most important things I want, and check it back after a few days, and cross out what's no longer true, and substitute. In the end, you will find that you come up with one or two things that are really important, and they have absolutely nothing to do with materiality. It's a very important thing to do, and it will be helpful to show one what path to take, which way to go, how to direct one's life, what is really the thing that one should pay attention to, give time for. If we realize that we're looking, and if you do this in your notebook, I'm sure most of you will realize that you're looking for inner joy and inner peace. Loving others is an essential ingredient. Disliking others is far too easy. Anybody can do it, does it all the time, justifies it, of course, because people are not very bright, they don't do the things we'd like them to do, and so on. And not only is it easy to dislike, it makes grooves in the heart of dislike, and it becomes easier and easier to dislike. And not only do we dislike others, connected with that is a dislike of ourselves. If one likes or loves oneself, which is the right way to say it, it's much easier to love others. And this is why we start every loving kindness meditation with the focus on ourselves and end it with the focus on ourselves. That's not egocentricity. If we don't like and love ourselves because we have this and that, our fault, have done this or that thing wrong, we will certainly also transplant that dislike to others and are constantly judging. It's a mistaken view that we are here to be judge and jury. First of all, we don't even have the qualifications. It's a very unsatisfactory job and doesn't get even paid for it. It just makes people unhappy within. Now, often people don't admit that to themselves and feel that it's necessary to be that way, to protect themselves. From what? What do we have to protect ourselves from? We have to protect our bodies from too much heat and too much cold. But why do we have to protect ourselves from love? People do think that way. There are two things which stop people from loving. One is that they're judging whether the other person that is in front of them is lovable. And the other one is that they want to protect their emotions in case somebody isn't going to accept them. That's a totally wrong way of looking at it. We are all in this together. We happen to live on this planet at the same time. We all breathe the same air. We all need the food to stay alive. And we all want peace and happiness. We all have the same limbs. We all have thoughts and emotions. There's absolutely no difference between us. That we are separate beings is an optical illusion. Obviously, at this point in time, we're still believing that optical illusion. That's all right. If we should practice properly and diligently and with perseverance and patience, one day we'll get over that optical illusion. It's not that we don't see people anymore, but the optical illusion of separation will no longer have any importance, because meditation, when it comes together, actually makes it possible to see the totality of all manifestation. There is one creation, and we're all part of it. So what are we afraid of? We're afraid to love ourselves. We're afraid to love creation. We're afraid to love the other. Why don't we do it? Most people don't. And yet, most of us who are sitting here will have heard from the time they were, as one says in Australia, knee-high to a grasshopper, love thy neighbor as thyself. So, everybody agrees. And who does it? It's not very popular. But what does it start out with? It starts out with loving oneself. And most people find that extremely difficult because we know ourselves. But that should not prevent us from loving ourselves just because we know ourselves. Knowing that we do things wrong, that we have unhappy thoughts, unwholesome thoughts, it's no reason not to love. When a mother loves her children, she doesn't stop loving them when they act silly and unpleasant. Continues loving them. And watching small children, they have hundreds of unwholesome thoughts in a day. And they give voice to them quite markedly. We have them too. But we often swallow them. We don't say them, but we know we have them. So if a mother can love a child, it's making all these difficulties for her, why can't we love ourselves? Loving oneself and knowing oneself are not the same thing. Love is the warmth of the heart, the connectedness, the protection, the caring, the concern, the being embraced in the warmth that comes from one's acceptance and understanding for oneself. Having practiced that, we are in a much better position to practice love towards others. They're just as unlovable as we ourselves are. They have just as many unwholesome thoughts as we have. But that doesn't matter. We are not judge and jury. Nobody has appointed us. We are self-appointed. Quite absurdly so. And when we realize that we can actually love ourselves, there's a sort of feeling of being at ease about oneself. One doesn't constantly have to become somebody or pretend to be somebody, or strive to be somebody, or try to make out one is somebody. One can just be. It's a very nice thing to just be and not have to be somebody. And love makes that possible. And by the same token, if we look at other people, we let them just be. And we can love them. Now we all have a daily opportunity to practice this. It's a skill, like any other. In our day-to-day living, we all meet up with numerous people. And some of them, of course, we find more pleasant than others. But what we can do is we can actually practice whether we can love that person. In the beginning, if we're honest, the answer will be, no, I can't love that person. It's a total stranger. What am I supposed to love that person? But as we practice a little more and get to know the Buddha's teaching better, we will realize that that person, stranger or not, has just as much dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, as we ourselves, is looking for the same joy and peace within, is trying very hard to be somebody, and eventually a feeling for that person can arise. One of the things which the Buddha advocated to practice this, is to become aware of the love one has for one's own children. Now, if we happen to have children, we know how we love them. And then check out that love that one has towards one's own children against the feeling one has for everybody else. It's an eye-opener. Now, if one doesn't have one's own children, not everybody has children, one can use the love of one's own mother towards oneself and check out the difference, how that feels and how we ourselves feel towards others. It's one of the injunctions in one of the famous discourses of the Buddha, the loving-kindness discourse, the Karaniya Metta Sutta. Just as a mother at the risk of life loves and protects a child, her only child, so one should cultivate this boundless love to all beings in the universe. Well, it's a start. Wherever we go, we have an opportunity to practice. Loving-kindness meditation, which we've done here twice already and will do again at the end of this session, is a method. It's a method which is helpful, but it's not enough. It takes, what, 10 minutes? And we have 17 hours of wakefulness in a day. If we don't practice it, then the 10 minutes is not going to make much difference. With the loving-kindness meditation, there's one thing to say about it. If you've done it here, and we'll do it again, and you didn't feel a thing, don't worry about it and don't despair. Where the mind goes, eventually the feelings follow. So it's important to continue this kind of meditation. In these 2 days, we have done 3 different methods: watching the breath and sitting, walking meditation, and loving-kindness meditation. That's enough to continue at home. Another thing about loving-kindness meditation is that it's very helpful to start every meditation session with loving-kindness towards oneself. A feeling of contentment, lovingness, acceptance, warmth and care for oneself. It need to take no more than a minute. If one can't feel anything, one can prolong it, of course. In fact, if the loving-kindness meditation didn't work at all, use a whole session for nothing else. If there wasn't any feeling at all, in fact, if the mind said, oh, I can't be bothered, it's very important to do it. But, as I said, it's not enough. In daily living, the opportunities are innumerable. Now, sometimes we come across a person whom we actively dislike. In fact, there are people whom we dislike without any real reason. Then others, of course, there are some that we have a reason or we make up a reason. It doesn't matter, it's still dislike. All 3 kinds are dislike. And what we usually do then is we try to get away from that person. Either we try to remove ourselves, or we try to remove the person if we have any influence. badly about the person, we try to do something about it, to give voice or even action to our dislike. That's the wrong way to handle that. If we come across somebody whom we actively dislike, whom we find very difficult, we should be utterly grateful. This is the best lesson that we can get, to learn that, to learn to love that which we consider unlovable. That's how one really learns the unconditional love, and that's what metta is. Metta is unconditional love, but it's also impersonal love. You see, we have to practice on people. It's too easy on animals. They don't talk back. No need to practice on them. That's easy. But people, we have to practice on them. But when we have practiced to some extent and at length and have actually made some progress, we will also find that the lovingness in our heart is nothing personal. It's got nothing to do with the person that we are confronting. It's got even nothing to do with our own person. It's just the warmth of, the quality of warmth, a quality of togetherness, a quality of not non-judgmental being that we feel within ourselves. So we can call metta impersonal love. Now, sometimes when people hear that, they worry about it, what that will do into their family life. It will improve at no end. Because what it does is, it takes away the fear. The fear of not being loved, the fear of losing these people, the fear that is always present and that makes one, so to say, dependent upon the other people. When the love becomes impersonal, it's pure and only giving. One doesn't expect anything. And that's why I said in the loving kindness meditation that we have done so far, in the two we have done, that when it came to the people that are closest to us, give them your love, but don't expect anything back. When we don't expect anything, we can't be disappointed. Very often people measure love as if it was gold that you could put on a scale. I give that much, I want the same amount back. I mean, it's absurd. We know it's absurd, and still people do it. And if I don't get the same amount back, I'll give a little less. All of that has nothing to do with a loving heart. The far enemy of love is hate. That's easily seen. That's no difficulty. But the near enemy to love is attachment. And that's difficult to see. Because attachment appears to be love and is also imbued with love. But it isn't pure love. It's a kind of love that wants to have and to keep. On the other hand, that kind of love which we find in the family that wants to have and to keep is a very good beginning. And if we know and use that kind of feeling, we can enlarge upon it, we can extend it. We know what it feels like. It's a constant challenge. But life without a challenge is pretty boring. Some people climb high mountains to have a challenge, or go around the world in a little sailboat to have a challenge. I think this kind of challenge is easily as difficult and, I'm sure, much more beneficial. To have our heart challenged like that, in the beginning might seem very difficult, but as soon as we feel the slight stirring in the heart, we realize something is happening and we realize that there is a change occurring. And all of a sudden, people are no longer so difficult. People are no longer such a threat when they want something. Some people feel so threatened by other people's wants that they try to get away from that. We can't get away from each other. Have you ever considered the fact that we're all totally dependent upon each other? What we eat comes from the farm. It gets packaged by somebody, taken to the supermarket. Then we go and buy it. Somebody has to check it out. Our houses are built by somebody. Our telephone system is looked after by somebody. Our roads are repaired by somebody. The clothes we wear are made by somebody. We're sick, we go to a doctor. We can't get along without other people. We're constantly dependent on everything around us, on everybody. We wouldn't even have come here if we'd been the only one. We're supported by others, by their interest. We can't remove ourselves just because we feel threatened or scared, or just have enough contact which is necessary to survival and still feel threatened and scared. It's not a good quality of life. A good quality of life is openness, lovingness, beingness. We have the mistaken view that we have to become somebody. We don't have to become anybody. We are already what we're supposed to be. We just don't know it. We are exactly what we're supposed to be. How else could we ever become it? We don't have to get something. We just have to let go. Have to let go of our separations, of our boundaries, of our viewpoints and ideas, who we are and who all these other people are. They're exactly like we. You can go to the other end of the world, they're still the same as we are. They might have a different skin color, but that's about it. They speak a different language, but inside they're exactly the same. There's no difference. So when we get an idea like that, that we are just one small part of the whole of creation, it will also help us to feel less threatened, less scared, more connected, easier to love. If you think for a moment of yourself, 5'5" on an average, 6, 7, 8, 9, whatever, weighing between 120 and 180 pounds or something like that. So look at that one person that's called me. And then you know, without any difficulty, that there are 6 billion like you on this planet. Well, you can't visualize 6 billion. I can't. But we know it's a big number. Well, then we look at this planet, and you've probably seen some pictures taken from satellite. That tiny little planet in a galaxy, which is full of planets and stars and all sorts of things. One galaxy. And then we realize that with the very strong telescopes, the astronomers can see other galaxies, a few. And then we also know that there are innumerable galaxies. The Buddha said about himself that he is a minor Buddha, the one that we know, Siddhartha Gautama. He's a minor Buddha. He has influence over 10,000 galaxies. That's a minor Buddha. There must have been some major ones that had more galaxies. Well, let's just take 10,000 galaxies. Okay. And there's this planet we call Earth, our home. And that's whirling around at enormous space, pace in space. And on it are all these people. And we are one. One little person. Now that doesn't mean that we're unimportant. But it means that we're together. It means that we must put things into perspective. We must see things a little differently from what our daily life depicts. Now, daily life, it all, everything seems important. Telephone calls we get, the letters that are written, everything seems important. What somebody says, is that really important in this galaxy? On this planet? What's important? Write it down in your own diary. What's important? And you will find what's important are inner states of being. Everything out there. It's like the backdrop in a theater. That's all it is. It's got nothing to do with one's inner being. We all live according to our inner being. Whatever the backdrop, what does it matter? There are houses and trees, different houses, different trees, there are deserts, all on this little planet. It's important for the cultivation of the kind of heart and mind that will be able to live at ease and at peace, to see universality. And from that universality, to direct oneself towards one's own individuality. When we do that, we have a better perspective. And the Buddha's teaching is geared towards that. And loving people, impersonal, unconditional love, no conditions attached, is geared towards that. Because love is the one emotion which makes it possible for us to live together. Wherever love is lost, people cannot live together. Not only can they not live together, very often they kill each other, which is constantly happening. I read somewhere in a statistic that in this century we have had 91 wars. Quite a dreadful record, isn't it? Well, that can't happen if we were to love each other. But don't misunderstand that. We don't go out and tell others to love. We do it ourselves. I'm only interpreting the Buddha's teaching. Every single one of us who learns to love is a boon to mankind. Because that is an emanation which comes out from that person and touches others around them. There is universal consciousness, and within that universal consciousness there is love. If we love, we can touch upon that, touch upon the love in universal consciousness and add to it. Have that as our gift to mankind. No expectation that anybody's going to love us back. It doesn't matter whether they do or not. If they want to learn to love, they will. If we are a good example, it might be helpful. There's no better way to teach anyone anything except through example. Parents know that, or most of them anyway. The Buddha said, we're all like children. Although we have outgrown the size of a child, we're like children within. He said, we are playing with our toys in a house on fire and haven't got enough sense to let go of the toys and jump out of that house, but get burned in the process. We get burned through our negative emotions. Everybody knows what it feels like to hate. It's a burning sensation that's extremely unpleasant. Everybody knows what it's like to get angry. It's most unpleasant. particularly for the one who gets angry, but it's also unpleasant for one's environment. So we don't want to let go. So we continue like children. And the Buddha's teaching is geared towards making us grow up, mature in heart and mind, purification of heart and mind. I'd like to give you a few moments if you'd like to ask some questions, and then we'll do a loving kindness meditation together. I know you can't use those words, they're much too long. The breath isn't long enough for that. You can use 1, 2, 3 if you want to. But if you do beginning, middle, end of breath, the best way is to be only attentive to that without trying to say anything. To say in and then middle and end, it's just too much. So there certainly is a middle to it. Everything that arises stays a moment and then ceases. So that moment that it stays, that's the middle of it. And then before it's, then it ceases again. It takes a fair bit of pinpointed attention to become aware of this beginning, middle, end. And if it doesn't work too well for you, use one of the others. Doesn't matter, they're all methods. A method is a method by any name. It doesn't matter which one. But if you like it, then try to do it without words. Okay? Well, you have already watched it, otherwise you wouldn't know that it's there. So you might as well straighten out, or straighten up rather. Okay? Yes. Sorry, I can't understand. Say it slowly. You find it almost impossible to extend loving kindness to whom? I didn't catch everything, but I presume that you're saying that you can't have love for people who are doing the wrong things. Is that right? Okay. Well, yeah, most people do that deliberately. The answer to that is we don't love the crime, but we don't have to hate the criminal. And it takes a lot of practice. A lot. And it takes meditation. Without meditation, the heart and the mind just haven't got the strength. It takes practice. And when the practice does come together, there's a different dimension for one's own life. The dimension has been deepened. There's a deeper dimension to it. Naturally, people do wrong things. Well, we all know that. All you have to do is open the newspaper. I mean, it's very, very simple. But the simple things are not the things that make us happy. So we don't like the crime, but we don't have to hate the criminal. And it's a great challenge, if one wants to. If one doesn't want to do it, that's all right. Buddha never coerced anybody in doing anything. He just gave the instructions and said, if you like, you can try it, and if you don't, well, don't. It's quite all right. Yeah. You mean the physical contact, whether that's important? Well, Southern Europeans are more into physical contact. You have to remember that Australians are still, to a great extent, of the English ancestry. And in England, one doesn't touch one another. Not on the street or anywhere. I mean, at home, sure. So Italians do. And Italians are far more volatile, as a rule, than English people. So you have a different ambience there. You have a different expression. But in a family, it's utterly important that the children, for instance, have touch contact with the parents. It's essential. It's nice to have touch contact in that friendly manner, but if it isn't part of the society, one can't, blame anybody that it isn't happening. It's just not the way people do things, you know. So it is a nice thing to do. But if it isn't done, well, they'll have to express their love differently, you know. Yes. Well, we usually say twice a day, once in the morning, once in the evening. If you've got more time, do it as often as you have time. But twice a day at least, once in the morning, once in the evening, so that the thing becomes, solidified, the meditation. It never amounts to anything if one only does it sporadically. Everybody knows that. It never gets anywhere. So twice a day would be the minimum. Then, of course, if one can do it well, whatever. Yes. If there is a hate state. Are you saying that if one is in a hateful state, one shouldn't meditate? Is that what you're saying? Yeah, okay. This hall is too big. I can't hear. yes, you... When one has hate in one's heart, the meditation isn't going to work. The calm meditation is not working. But one can sit down and investigate, why am I hating? And then the answer is a new question. and thereby get a better insight into oneself. In other words, not a serenity meditation, but more a contemplation for insight. And that can be very helpful. Of course, if the hate is very, very strong, even that might not be possible. One has to first start scrubbing the floor or something. And after having done that, maybe sit down and do it. So part of the meditation, part of meditative preconditions is a joyful mind. That's a precondition for good meditation. But of course, one doesn't always have that. So one can do investigation. We have dozens of methods. I can only suggest that you come to the retreat and we'll do some. Buddha had dozens of methods, and we do have them. And I will teach some at the retreat. I only mentioned today the impermanence of the breath and the movements. So, and of course, knowing one's thinking pattern and that. Because the purification is the most important beginning, but yes, there are many methods for insight. Yes, and some of them are contemplations, and some of them are meditations. Anything else? Yes. But have you investigated why you're so devastated when you come home? Mentally demanding. Yeah. Okay. Well, I can give you one clue how to make it less demanding. But you have to actually do it. Don't look for results. Just give your best, that's all. Don't look for results in the way of appreciation, in the way of being right, in the way of having the boss praise you, your co-workers like you. Don't look for any results. And half of the stress is gone, probably more. Okay, then you're really looking for results when you have your own company. You've got to have the result of making it work. That's where the stress comes in. It's only the result thinking that brings the stress. Nothing else. Naturally, with that kind of stress, you can't meditate. First of all, try to see the result thinking in order to get to know yourself and find the result thinking and try to do less of it anyway. I mean, you can't eliminate it, but do less of it, you know. So if the company goes, it's fine. If it doesn't go, it has to be fine too. And then at night, well, maybe if you have a shower and a rest, and then the mind is still in the business, isn't it? The mind is still running the company. Yeah, well, resolved thinking. I can't say that you should give up your company. I mean, that's a drastic step. But you can give up result thinking. You can try anyway. See whether you can do something. Yes. Any practice on what?
Can we recommend any practice or method to cure the sensual desire?
Oh, yes, yes, certainly. Well, I wouldn't say it's going to cure it, but it certainly will minimize it, or won't eliminate it. The elimination of sensual desire happens for the non-returner, which is one step before enlightenment. So you can see that it's pretty well entrenched in our being. So sensual desire, the strongest one is sexual desire. It's the strongest of all sensual desires. All the others are minor compared to sexual desire. And the best antidote for that is a meditation practice where you imagine you have a zipper in front of your body, your own of course, and you open up the zipper and then you take out all the bits and pieces that you know that are in there. And you try to visualize them as well as you can. Most people do know what a body consists of. It doesn't matter if you miss a few. And you also try to get a feel for them, how they feel when you touch them. And you lay them out neatly in front of you. Gallbladder, kidneys, intestines, bile, everything that you can find. And you do the same with your head also. And then having done all that, you know, get to the bones. And you get out all the bones and heap them up nicely and neatly. And then, of course, by that time, the skin will have shrunk and will have fallen together. And then you look at this mess and you investigate and see, where am I in all that? And, of course, the mind immediately says, well, no, I am not here at all. And then you quickly put everything back in, zip it up again, and have a sigh of relief because you're back. And if you do that several times, the physical aspect of one's being becomes far more realistic. It's not a pleasure grove. It is just made up of bits and pieces. And it doesn't eliminate desire, but it certainly puts it into a better perspective. So if that is the strongest hindrance, this kind of meditation can be very helpful, but always to do it with oneself, not with anybody else, and to do it not superficially, but quite concentrated. And if the mind doesn't like it, that means one really should do it. Whenever the mind says, I don't like that, that means that one is very much attached to whatever it is that was happening. You can try. Yes.
I found the walking meditation easier to keep the distracted thoughts to me, even if my eyes are open, than the sitting with meditation. If there are out of these three methods with your thoughts, is there anything which is better, or is this better suited to the situation?
No. Nothing is better or worse. If you can do walking meditation better than watching the breath, it will be quite useful for you to do that. If you have a place at home where you can do it, it will be quite useful. When you get really concentrated in the walking meditation after some time, you will find that you will want to sit down. So it will be quite good to do it with the walking and then. All right, we'll do a guided loving kindness meditation. Please put the attention on the breath for just a few moments. Think of your most beloved person, and then get the feeling for for that most beloved person in your heart. Become aware of that feeling you have for that most beloved person. The warmth and the caring, the concern, the togetherness. Feel all that for your most beloved person. And then transfer exactly that same feeling to yourself. No difference between you and the beloved person. Same warmth, the same care, the same togetherness, the same embracing. Recognize the feeling for the most beloved person once more. And then transfer that feeling to the person sitting nearest you. No difference between people. The loving heart can embrace everyone. And now think of your parents, whether they're still alive or not. And let them have the same feeling that you have for your most beloved person. Reaching out to their hearts, letting them feel the togetherness and connectedness. Embracing them with your care and concern. Think of your nearest and dearest people and let them feel your love and care and concern without expecting to get the same back, just giving them the gift of your heart. Think of your good friends. Let them arise before your mind's eye. And let them have the same love that you give to your most beloved person. Wishing them well, embracing them with warmth and care. and think of the people whom you meet in your daily life. Neighbors, people at work, in the offices, shops, on the street, public transport, workmen, postmen, whoever comes to your mind, and arouse a feeling for your most beloved person, and then give it to each one of these people that you meet in your daily life. Let them be part of your heart. Think of anyone towards whom you're quite indifferent, a neutral feeling. You neither like nor dislike. And then bring the feeling for your most beloved person into your heart and give it as a gift to that person towards whom you are indifferent. Make that person also part of your heart connection. Now think of somebody whom you find difficult, with whom you've had an argument, or you're angry with that person, or the person is angry with you, or there are some difficulties. Now bring up the feeling for your most beloved person. Have it quite clear in your heart. And then reach out to the difficult person. Embrace that difficult person with the same love and concern and care that you give to your beloved person. Realizing that this is the test for your own heart, and when you make peace with that person,